My name is Einat Wilf, and this is the We Should All Be Zionists podcast. Each week, I'll be reading one essay from my latest collection of essays book, We Should All Be Zionists, on issues facing the Jewish people and Israelis today: conflict, peace, religion, politics, past, present, and future. At the end, I'll be joined by columnist Blake Flayton for a discussion on the themes of the essay and how they apply to contemporary Israel and Jewish life. You can purchase your own copy of We Should All Be Zionists anywhere you get your books. Thanks for listening. Let's start. Zionism and Feminism, essay for the Journal of Contemporary Antisemitism, co-authored with Shani Moore, January 2018. Feminism and Zionism are cut from the same cloth. Both movements emerged from the same intellectual and political origins. They both exhibited similar growth trajectories, becoming two of the most successful revolutions to sweep and survive through the 20th century. Both continue to face ferocious backlash, and both remain vibrant and necessary in the 21st century. Feminism and Zionism are daughters of the Enlightenment. They were born of that intellectual revolution against the inevitability of the human condition as one subject to a hierarchical, divinely ordained order underpinned by a religious system and elaborate theology. Feminism and Zionism are rebellions against that order. They are both part of the modern overthrowing of a pre-modern order in which each living creature, born into a station and role in the superstructure of society, remains in that role, carries it out dutifully, and does not challenge it. Feminism and Zionism are infused with resistance against the pre-Enlightenment idea that how you are born should determine how you die. Feminism and Zionism are ongoing rebellions against millennia-long power structures that assigned women and Jews a proper place in society. For women, it was an order dating back to the beginning of the agricultural era that simultaneously enabled and necessitated their control as child-bearing properties. For Jews, it was a theological and by extension social assignation of their inferior role by the two civilizations that emerged from Judaic monotheism, but also claimed to supersede it, Christianity and Islam. Having made the claim to be the bearer of a new truth in the form of a New Testament or a new uncorrupted prophecy, the two civilizations could not but develop an adverse attitude toward those Jews who refused conversion and rejected the claims of both these civilizations to be the better and truer interpretations of the original scriptures. Naturally, Christianity, the more direct descendant of Judaism, was more ferocious in its theological and social loathing to those remaining Jews who still would not accept Christ. But Islam, too, was clear in its theology, as well as legal, social, and symbolic structures, that Jews, even when tolerated, were certainly not and could not be the equals of Muslims. Entire cultural structures, civilizations, were built on the edifice of female and Jewish inferiority, so much so that these themes in their multitude of expressions were transparent to those who were raised into those structures. Themes that emphasized female submission and exalted the limited role assigned to women were reinforced in a myriad of ways, from the most minute social norms to legal structures, to almost every form of cultural output, from poetry to painting to children's stories. It was this near endless replication of only one possible model of female human life that created a sense of inevitability. If one is born a woman, destined to do one thing, bear children to her master, then one inevitably lives her life and dies a woman having done only this one thing, if she is lucky. And it is by this thing alone that her entire value is judged. Themes that emphasized the moral failure of the Jew were the staple of Christian and some Muslim cultural creations, from scriptures to paintings to children's tales to linguistic idioms. Since the continued existence of the Jews implied a rejection of Christianity and Islam, the Jew could not be conceived of as a moral being choosing wisely between good and evil. At best, Jews could be tolerated as relics, headed for the dustbin of history, against the inevitable progress of Christianity and Islam. At worst, their continued existence was an intolerable offense, necessitating the exaction of a price. Most commonly, their inferior status, vulnerability, and persecution served as evidence to the fate that awaits those who persist in their rejection of the true path. Feminism and Zionism challenged all that. They were both forms of refusal to accept the role that others have assigned to women and Jews. They were forms of self-assertion that cried out, "I refuse to be seen how you wish to see me. I refuse to be that which you want me to be. I am not your inferior. I can be so much more than I am allowed to be. And I insist on being free to explore and make the most of my humanity." In that, feminism and Zionism were built on self-definition and human agency. Both these movements could emerge only once the secular and radical idea that human beings, individually and collectively, are masters of their fate was introduced. Once human beings could be conceived of as active agents of historical change rather than passive receivers of divine fate, women and Jews could begin to formulate the notion that even if one might be dealt some of the worst cards in history, and by a whole lot of dealers, it does not mean that there is nothing to be done. Something could be done, but for feminism and Zionism to challenge power structures that have existed for millennia and have been predicated on women and Jews knowing their place, they could only do so on the footsteps of the modern political revolutions embodying the ideals of liberty, equality, and group solidarity. True, neither women nor Jews were to be included initially in the ideals of equality. But once the ideal of liberating human beings from submission, the essential equality of human life, and the necessity of group solidarity and mobilization for achieving these goals were introduced, it was impossible to prevent these ideas from being adopted, even by those whom the revolution did not initially expect to include. Feminism and Zionism arose from anger at this kind of hypocrisy. Feminism and Zionism developed as those claiming to espouse the ideals of equality and liberty and solidarity twisted themselves into ideological and religious knots to justify keeping women and Jews out of this new world. Feminism and Zionism came into their own as the logical trajectory of equality among human beings could not but be extended to those who could also lay legitimate claim to being human beings, even if somewhat different from the mold. It was the growing ability of women and Jews to lay claim to being human beings worthy of equality and liberty, as well as their ability to mobilize their respective groups to make that claim, that made the success of their revolutions possible. As women became more literate and educated with direct access to knowledge, it became harder to justify their exclusion from that which was considered worthy only of the formerly exclusively literate, such as the right to vote or to attain higher education. Once women had the right to vote, and they became highly educated, it became increasingly harder to exclude them from other areas of life. For Jews, as the promise of integration and emancipation into European society led them to greater achievements from science to art to literature, their continued exclusion under the guise of the new scientific ideology of antisemitism, rather than plain old Christian or Islamic theology, became ever less tolerable. As Theodor Herzl and other Jews who initially believed that they were lucky enough to live in an age of progress, equality, and tolerance, a time in which they would no longer be excluded from full participation in the dominant society by virtue of being Jews, came to realize that while Europe spoke of equality, it failed to practice it. They realized that their true emancipation and liberation from dependency on others would only be possible when they are truly masters of their fate, collectively governing themselves in a state of their own. Alas, feminist women and Zionist Jews proved themselves ingrates. The more they attained, the more they wanted. Unable to celebrate what they were given, they exhibited an annoying tendency to not just care about being somewhat better off than before, but to actually want true equality. It was a tendency that was often resisted by women and Jews themselves, who feared that the fragile achievements they already had would be endangered by movements that insisted on pressing ever forward. The problem with feminism and Zionism was that no matter how successful they were, what achievements they brought about for women and Jews, it never seemed to be enough. This was especially exasperating to some, given that feminism and Zionism were two of the most successful revolutions to emerge from Enlightenment thinking. What began as insane ideas of a mad few became, over a breathtakingly short time, more broadly accepted. The achievements of both movements in each turn were remarkable and of a nature that only a short while earlier would have been considered unthinkable and impossible. Wherever and whenever feminism and Zionism swept through societies, they turned them upside down and inside out. By changing the very image of what it means to be a woman or what it means to be a Jew, it forced change on societies and civilizations that were predicated on a very specific and limited image of what it meant to be either of those things. That change was not always welcome. In fact, it was resisted at every turn, often violently, even ferociously. The more power of various kinds that was amassed by women and Jews, the more their rise felt like an offense to the proper order of things. The challenge of feminism and Zionism to millennia-long power structures was never going to go over unchallenged. It is in the very nature of power that no one ever gives it up willingly and easily. If women and Jews seemed unable to know their proper place and intent on demanding more, then they must be placed back in their proper place, if needed, by force. Indeed, any Jewish or female aspiration to power was conceived as a provocation. Those supposed provocations became legitimate explanations and exculpations for resisting the liberation of both groups. It has been taken as a given that women and Jews who insist on their equality need to make more allowances for the ability of their opponents to restrain themselves, and if they fail to do so, they are berated. It is therefore no coincidence that wherever and whenever women and Jews grew in prominence, their rise was met with increasing violence. The so-called Icelandic paradox of a country where women have the most rights and face the greatest incidence of domestic violence is no paradox at all. The fact that the greatest forms of violence against Jews came against the backdrop of their growing success and prominence is no accident either. Even in the lands of Islam, where Jews historically were better treated than in Christian lands, not a particularly high bar, trouble to the Jews arose when Jews were seen to be getting too much power, writes Bernard Lewis in The Jews of Islam. Lewis explains that when persecution occurred, the usual argument was that the Jews had violated the pact by overstepping their proper place. Therefore, it is no accident, he argues, that it is during the 19th and 20th centuries when the dhimmis, protected Jews, were no longer prepared to accept or respect the rules that the most violent and bloody clashes have occurred. Direct violence has not been the only method by which the backlash against the aspirations of women and Jews for equality has been implemented. Various insidious ways, mostly transparent to those who grew up under cultural expressions designed to signal the proper place for women and Jews, were employed. Despite the secularization of the Christian world, the moral failure of the Jew remained a central theme of discourse, with only the moral failures themselves changing. It could be capitalism or communism or socialism, colonialism, racism or fascism, but the Jewish challenge to the order of things was presented as something that is deeply immoral. For women, the old ideas about their proper place found new vehicles, whether in the form of the beauty myth or religious modesty. And so entire cultures and civilizations were mobilized to drive a wedge between the good woman and the bad feminist, between the good Jew and the bad Zionist. The difference between the good and the bad? Power. A good woman does not aspire to power. In fact, she feels uncomfortable with it and would be more than happy to forgo it. A good Jew feels queasy with manifestations of Jewish power, and in the face of raw expressions of it, rushes to declare his or her renunciation of Zionism. It is no accident that the forms of female and Jewish expressions that are most mocked, criticized, and denigrated are those that involve the expression of power. Indeed, women and Jews are also denied the right to define the terms of their liberation. Feminists constantly are required to bear the burden of proof that feminism is not a term for subjugating men. And Zionists struggle to reclaim the word Zionism from those who have tirelessly worked to equate it with all of the world's evils. These means have been employed because if the revolutions of feminism and Zionism are ever to be stalled and even rolled back, women and Jews must come to feel uneasy with power. It might be baffling to a 21st century reader as to why movements that sought nothing more than equality should continue to face such ferocious backlash. Equality has come to sound so benign, obvious, a taken-for-granted marker of modern society. But when one understands that true equality leads inexorably to a redistribution of power and resources, then it becomes quite understandable why it is that, to those accustomed to privilege, equality feels a whole lot like discrimination. To those young enough to never have known a world where when equality was not the norm, it is even more difficult to appreciate the hangover effect of historical power structures. Young men in the West might no longer individually think that women are their inferiors, but they would need to exhibit remarkable blindness to argue that they do not inhabit a world in which the social structures, norms, and cultural output were shaped by this assumption. Young people, who have always known only a powerful state of Israel, might fail to comprehend how the obsession of large parts of Western and Islamic civilization with Israel is an expression of their inability still to come to terms with Jewish power, and are therefore prone to confusing cause and effect, thinking that the Western and Islamic obsession with Israel is about what Israel does rather than about what Israel is, an expression of Jewish self-mastery and power. It is in the nature of feminism and Zionism that their proponents cannot rest until they have reached true equality, until the resources of power are redistributed so that women and Jews are no longer ever in danger of being put back in their place. This can only be achieved with the transformation of the civil national systems that have determined what that proper place is. This is why feminism does not stop with education, voting, reproductive rights, equal pay at work, and safety at work. The more it gains, the more it exposes how entrenched the assumption of female inferiority is in the structures of society, and the more it presses onward to dismantle them. This is why Zionism has not ended with the establishment of a state for the Jewish people, because the idea of equal sovereign Jews governing a share of the earth's land on their own continues to be ferociously resisted by the large swath of the two civilizations that were built on the assumption of Jewish disappearance, often with the declared intention of rolling back that Jewish transgression in the form of the State of Israel. These revolutions cannot stop because it quickly becomes apparent that the rewards for playing by the rules of the established power system, for succumbing to the pressure to be a good Jew or a good woman, are fleeting at best. Good Jews and good women who publicly renounce their fellow bad Zionists and bad feminists ultimately never found protection in that position from the violence and backlash inflicted on their group. Women who have abjured liberation or certain aspects of it found themselves no more immune to violence against women than the ones who stood at the forefront of the liberation movement. Good Jews who have publicly renounced any group affinity with bad Zionists or any of the bad Jews of the moment ultimately found that they were no more protected from violence and hatred towards Jews than their fellow Jews. In the lands of Islam, the Jews who suffered most and were the immediate target of violence and persecution were precisely those good Jews who should have been protected. Those who were not involved in Zionist undertakings were no more protected from violence, persecution, and expulsion than those who were. Feminism and Zionism started out as revolutions for changing the fate of women and Jews. But as they grew in power and faced growing backlash, they became revolutions for civilizational and transformation. Neither feminism nor Zionism will rest until new civilizations, entire cultural systems, emerge to replace those that were predicated on the assumption of female and Jewish otherness and inferiority. Not until almost all men feel completely at ease with the idea of powerful women, and most Westerners and Muslims feel at ease with the idea of powerful Jews, could those revolutions call it a day, and neither should they.
So, Einat, before we get into a broader conversation on the content of this piece, and it really is, I think, one of your best, and it's, I think, one of your most impactful. I remember, I'm pretty sure one of the first times that I was made aware of you and your work that you do was in a video where someone, a student, asked you a question about what would you say about the charge that Zionism is racism? And you responded pretty much word for word with what this paragraph from the piece says. And you write, "The difference between the good and the bad, power. A good woman does not aspire to power. In fact, she feels uncomfortable with it and would be more than happy to forgo it. A good Jew feels queasy with manifestations of Jewish power, and in the face of raw expressions of it, rushes to declare his or her renunciation of Zionism. It is no accident that the forms of female and Jewish expressions that are most mocked, criticized, and denigrated are those that involve the expression of power." Which for me, and I remember posting it on my Instagram story to thunderous applause from my followers and lots of DMs going, "Oh my God, who is this person? And how do we see more?" And I think this was during COVID. I was living in my parents' house. It was just spectacular because it resonates with so many of us, not only in the argument that it makes, but also in our experiences. And it resonated so much with young people, I feel like, because at my university, power and identity was so important. It was a form of currency. If you had a marginalized identity and you sort of crafted your personality or your way of being to be about proudly and strongly taking charge of that identity and adhering to a philosophy where equality wasn't enough. You know, it was about influence, and it was about recognition, and it was about level equity, right? We hear that all the time. Whether, you know, Black students, LGBT students, women students, I know we're going to get to that later, But for Jewish students, there was such a blaring double standard where all the other expressions of power and pride and in the classroom and extracurricular activities were welcomed and so valuable and were even revered, except when it came from Jews. So we're going to get to feminism later, but first and foremost, why does this double standard exist at all?
So my view on a lot of things is that really, if you want to understand anything in the present, you go back. You go into history, you sometimes go deep into history. And one of the things that I found most troubling in general, but especially when it comes to thinking about Israel and Jews, is this completely ahistorical attitude. This notion that we only have the present and what it doesn't matter what happened before. So Israel is powerful in the present. So we're not going to even ever discuss the condition of Jews in the past. That's it. All that matters is that Israel is now on the side of the powerful. And therefore, we go back, and that means that always Israel, Jews were always on the side of the powerful. We're never going to recognize that it was ever different. And there was just a sense that you don't understand anything about the West. You don't understand anything about the Arab world. There was this complete reversal of cause and effect. Israel is being evil. And that's why we're angry at Israel. That's why Arab countries, that's why the Palestinians, Israel is the cause, rather than understanding that the deep cause is the very way that Western and Islamic civilization has been structured with respect to the role of Jews. And to understand how deeply Zionism challenges that role and as a result, it challenges the civilizations. It basically takes away one of their shiniest toys. It takes away the idea that Jews have a special role and they want the shiny toy back. So they're going to keep pushing for the Jews to have that role. And that's why the double standards, because Jews are not supposed to celebrate their self-determination and equity and power.
It's just extraordinary when you think about it from a historical lens, because it appears as if we're the only group that is subjected to that standard, that double standard. I mean, coming from the LGBT community, I am, you know, the luckiest generation ever. My parents' generation, you know, gay kids in their generation couldn't even fathom what that power was and what that acceptance was and influence on the culture. I mean, we've always influenced the culture, but now it's just flagrant. It's out there. We don't need to hide it anymore. And it's celebrated in left-wing spaces and it's glorified because, and it's still not enough. You know, they push harder and harder and harder for more representation, for more inclusion, for more power in social spaces. And yet the Jews, there's just this disconnect here, this massive disconnect. So it's fascinating to look at it from that perspective. Going a little bit onto the feminist route and sticking with sort of the themes of the left, I remember there was an organization on my college campus that was made up primarily of women, of young women students. And their mission statement was to support survivors of sexual assault, whether it be on campus, off campus, you know, mitigating with administration, whatever. And a couple years ago, they had posted a graphic on Instagram that basically said, in short, that Zionism and feminism were incompatible and that there would be no room for Zionists or normalization of Zionism within our organization, because look at all of these things, these terrible things that Israel does to Palestinian women. And of course, the outrage came soon after from Jewish students, but that's not a outlier or an anomaly. Everyone knows, or I hope most people know about, there was a march in Washington, D.C. when I was a college student for lesbian pride, which had a very, you know, strong feminist presence and feminist rhetoric and messaging. And they banned the Megan David pride flag because they said it was a nationalist symbol. So if you're saying that feminism and Zionism are linked because they're both born from the Enlightenment and they both challenge power structures, why isn't that resonating with feminists, or I'm not going to blanket statement all feminists, of course, but why is that resonating with such loud feminist spaces?
So that's certainly the question that motivated me to write this piece, because I was just struck by how nonsensical that idea is. My pinned tweet on Twitter is that Zionism is a progressive cause that had the misfortune of success. The notion is that, yeah, at one point you actually want progress. That's the idea of being progressive. You want to better your situation, but there's a kind of, as soon as you better your situation, and certainly for Jews, there's something so profoundly wrong about it that you have all this backlash. And I think there was something similar with feminism. And this is what prompted me to write that. I'm not sure I have the answer. Clearly, part of the answer is that movements, ideas that want to be part of the political moment of the progressive alliance understand that the political alliance right now is in many ways organized against Zionism. Ruth Weiss has always called anti-Semitism the political organization against the Jews. She highlights anti-Semitism not as a prejudice or a worldview, but actually as a form of political organization that proves itself again and again as very valuable. I think that's a big part of it, that just instinctively, intuitively, a lot of these movements are finding that by politically organizing against Zionism, they're able to ensure allies in a lot of other places, because we can't ignore the fact, I mean, you talked about how all the other movements on campus, you could celebrate power, but I'm already beginning to see that in some places, women, feminism is now spoken about as a matter of privilege, right? We now begin to talk about white women feminism and that form of privilege, and gay, just being gay with nothing else, is now a form of privilege because you're done. And so we're seeing how, in many ways, the progressive movement can't just deal with success. It can't say, this is really great that all these people have power now. It immediately turns it around and says they're now privileged. So I think still using the political organization against Zionism, against powerful Jews, is proving as politically useful as it ever was. But ideologically, intrinsically, it makes no sense at all. And this is why I wrote the piece.
Right. And we're all very happy that you did, because I think it tackles that assumption very, very well. Now shifting gears to more of what's happening inside of Israel with the Zionists themselves, the Zionists who ascribe to an ideology that we both agree is akin to feminism and its political program. The state of women in Israel today, and I will just tie it to the news a couple days ago on Yom Kippur, as the sun was setting on Yom Kippur, there was a religious organization that attempted to erect a mechitza, which is a separation barrier between men and women, in Kikar Dizengoff, in the heart of Tel Aviv, for a Yom Kippur service. And this Yom Kippur service has been happening there since the pandemic, which is why they do it outdoors. But the Tel Aviv municipality told them they couldn't do it. It went to the municipal court. They told them they couldn't do it. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, which said that the municipality of Tel Aviv could essentially decide what it wanted to do with its own public space. To make a long story short, the barrier was set up. Protesters descended on the scene, ripped down the barrier, started intimidating the worshipers. There were various clashes between worshipers and protests and police, and it was very ugly. And the pictures and videos were very hard to watch, especially, you know, in the Jewish state on the holiest day. And of course, the backlash and the discourse from that has been all about gender and the public space and encroachment of religion. So I'm wondering, what is your take on the status of women now in Israel? Do we see it getting better or worse? And what do you make of these issues about, you know, the intrusion of religion into the public square? Are they overblown? Et cetera, et cetera.
So both in my feminism and Zionism over the years, the main insight and the reason that I've become an outspoken advocate of both is the realization that there are constant forces trying to roll them back, which means that you constantly have to push forward because that's the only way that you keep the gains alive. We have not yet, not with respect to Zionism, not with respect to feminism, globally or in Israel, achieved a point where we can go home. And this is what we're experiencing now in Israel and the Yom Kippur battle over the public space and whether women and men can be separated in the name of prayer and religion in the public space comes from a realization that this is a battle that if you don't move forward, there are forces trying to roll you back. And this is where a lot of people are getting confused because they're saying, well, we're open-minded, we're liberal, we're modern people, we should have room to be considerate of those with other ways of being. But this is a battle going around all over the world. You see it in Europe. Shani Moore, my co-author for this piece, says that whenever he hears about multiculturalism, he knows women are going to be on the losing end of that. Because often the idea is that you're going to tolerate, and typically what people are being asked to be tolerant of, is to be tolerant of very repressive attitudes towards women. So by now we have enough experience with the I call it fundamentalist, not religious, but the fundamentalist Jewish effort to roll back women's rights in Israel in the name of Zionism. They're trying to do it in the name of a fundamentalist Jewish interpretation. And the understanding that we have by now from decades of battle is that when you are considerate of them in the name of some kind of invented Jewish fundamentalism, they only ever push forward. So now with the kind of the resurgence of secular Zionism as part of the protests, there is what I think is an incredibly healthy and welcome understanding that we can't let this pass. And if we're going to be considerate in one space, they're just going to push forward and forward with their fundamentalist vision for what being Jewish is. And that's not what we want. So we're going to fight back.
And my last and final question is pretty basic, but also broad. What does the completion of the Zionist revolution look like in Israel and outside of Israel? And what does the completion of the feminist revolution look like in Israel and outside of Israel?
So it basically looks like the moment where Jews with power, where women with power are a complete non-issue. But it's not anything that we think about anymore. Like I'm sure there were a lot of revolutions happening in the 17th century, and they've become such a non-issue that we don't think about them anymore. So I'm imagining something like that. Things that have become such a non-issue that we don't need to fight and fight back and that there's no moving forward and backlash. It just is. Jews are sovereign. They have their own state. The state doesn't get any particular attention. Nobody cares about it one way or the other, no more than they care about, I don't know, Denmark for that matter. And the same, we're seeing women in power, women in positions of power becomes a completely non-issue, where women in power don't have likability issues because we actually like women in power. It's just this moment where it's a non-issue.
Well, inshallah, we'll be there very soon. Thank you so much, Einat. Really appreciate the conversation. מתעורר מה שהוא מתעורר